Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity for such a short notice, despite such short notice. Today I'd like to talk about condensation and phase separation of high TC systems inferred by superfluid density. Probably most of you know about our work on penetration depths and correlations between TC and superfluid density. So I will try to hopefully go through by 10 minutes of that for introduction. Next thing I would like to talk is our recent work in perturbation, phase separation in zinc doping, overdoping, static stripe formation systems, and compare it with helium films. That's the major part of today's talk. And then we'll talk about phase diagrams, Bose-Einstein BCS, and Kosteritz-Saures, that kind of thing. The motivation of our study can be very simple. In the Bose-Einstein condensation, you have a boson, and boson has a thermal wavelength at some temperature. And this, if the boson wave function starts to overlap, they make Bose condensation. So the temperature for Bose condensation is determined by the thermal wavelength and the density, and that means Bose condensation temperature is almost solely determined by the number density of bosons or superfluid divided by the effective mass. Okay. The BCS condensation is very different, and you have a Fermi surface, and it becomes superconducting when the gap is formed. And of course, still TC could depend in various ways with carrier density, but there's very little essential feature of that dependence, because just think about, you make the electron-photon interaction as twice as large, your gap will become twice, your TC will become twice, but the superfluid density will stay unchanged. And so we then are motivated to measure essentially various materials, various perturbations, and measure the superfluid density and see how the TC is correlated. But underlying motivation sometimes is just to compare these two cases. Okay, so for the next 10 minutes, perhaps you have seen all these few graphs, and so I will do it faster. But unless all of you know about our previous works. So to determine the superfluid density, muon spin relaxation is a very useful technique. So we apply external field and see the damping of muon spin precession. And in the superconducting state, we see this pronounced damping, which gives us the so-called muon spin relaxation rate sigma. And this is proportional to the superfluid density, actually. And so this damping is, of course, the result that in the superconducting, type 2 superconductors, in the applied field, your local field, is inhomogeneous due to the broadening. And this, how much your field inhomogeneity is determined by the penetration depth length scale. So the relaxation rate or damping rate is a measure of the inhomogeneous field, and it is fortunately proportional to 1 over penetration depth square. And that quantity is determined by the superfluid density, but I call superfluid density from now on NS over M star, with some correction for the dirty superconductors. This is just representing that supercurrent is causing this effect, and this is the conductivity of the supercurrent that we are measuring. So the damping rate for the clean superconductor is very simply proportional to 1 over lambda square, and represent the superfluid density NS over M star. Okay, so this measurement can tell us various things, but we would concentrate on the ground state value, so low temperature, T equals zero value of this superfluid density, measured superfluid density. And the first motivation was to compare how TC was related to this superfluid density. And so that was done in this plot. And especially for high TC cuprates in 1989, we found that TC is related linearly in the underdoped region like this with this superfluid density, in plane superfluid density. And it shows saturation in the optimum doped region, and in the overdoped region, TC comes down. We also made measurements on non-cuprate like buckyballs or PKDO or Chevrel, just to be fair with other materials. And somehow, many of those new type 2 superconductors have approximately the same ratio of TC and the superfluid volume density, superfluid density. The simplest thing we can do, of course, is that we are measuring N over M star, and if you know M star, you can count N. So then knowing HC2, you can count how many carriers you have in the coherence length region. And of course, BCS superconductors would have many, many carriers overlapping. The helium film that I will show you later is a representative Bose-Einstein-like situation. And you have a pair almost separated with each other. But this result of experimental result would give us, if you do try to get the same number, you have about several pairs overlapping with coherence length square for YBCO or organic superconductors. So this already more motivates us, advocates us that we should possibly see the phenomena in the crossover from this situation to this situation. Then we said that this superfluid density has dimension of energy. That's just, you can remember that Fermi temperature in 2D system is proportional to the number of carrier divided by the mass. And that is actually experimentally the relaxation rate, the 2D carrier density we have to multiply the inter-area distance to convert into two-dimensional story. But anyway, the observed relaxation rate or superfluid density would give us sort of effective Fermi temperature. In the three-dimensional case, here, of course, you have slightly different proportionality factor. So we have to employ some other information like Pauli susceptibility or Sommerfeld constant, which has different proportionality with N and M star. But we can get the number for this effective energy scale Fermi temperature very easily. And mostly, that number is determined by the superfluid density. So that conversion gave us this plot, where TC is plotted against this effective Fermi temperature. And this is just phenomenologically, this already shows that the new superconductors have very high TC with respect to this sort of typical energy scale of superfluid translational motion. These are the sort of typical BCS superconductors. And some people say that, then we have the numbers and mass. So we can calculate if it was the opposite limit of Bose condensation in free gas, what would be the Bose condensation temperature? And that is shown here. So actual TC of high TC is about four times or so reduced, five times maybe. It's also interesting to say that, you know, not only high TC, but all other superconductors have seemingly upper limit of this. But anyway, so some people say that this is already against the Bose condensation scenario. But I would like to stress that this linear relation actually is parallel, at least, to the basic relation for Bose condensation temperature. And so there may be very much of essence coming from Bose condensation in this linear relationship. Of course, TC can go down in various ways. If you have lower dimensional system, TC would go down. If you have overlap of carriers in the coherence length squared, TC would also be expected to go down. So this reduction of TC may reflect those various factors that I would come back later. Anyway, so
both of C60 comes pretty close to the line.
Yes. There's another C60 also coming from
somewhere here. The whole dot, the one that Grantmar just did.
Oh.
It's got a 52 Kelvin TC.
Oh, really?
It's whole dot.
I didn't know that.
FPG.
Uh-huh. If I come by, which
is it's 50 some Kelvin?
Yeah, it's supposed to be 40.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you won't
notice. Anyway, so just to remind you that what I called Fermi temperature is, of course, average energy scale obtained from raw energy measurement. You know, the penetration depth is omega equals zero measurement. And so we are approximating this kind of complicated whatever structure of density of state to this very simple way. And that is, in other words, the complicated optical conductivity. Of course, we are measuring the condensing spectral weight. So that corresponds to the so-called Drude part, and we are not sure, you know, including the mid-infrared part. And actually, Dmitry Basov made a nice plot that this USR or superfluid data, and his estimate of Drude part from normal state, actually missing normal state intensity, agrees reasonably well. And so this is to show that, so we can say probably if the word Fermi temperature, some people dislike it, then we can say it's a Drude temperature. Anyway, so this much is the area history. And let me show high TCs. We have various ways of perturbing systems, and usually TC goes down. And then how superfluid density behaves in that case, that I would show you. Okay. So first series of things I would like to show is this zinc doping. If you have, for example, this is undoped or without zinc. If you put zinc in 1-3, this sort of underdoped 1-3, TC and superfluid density goes on this line. If you start from this, again, non-zinc 2-1-4, with more and more zinc, it would go down this way. And also, with start from overdoping 2-1-4, it would go down this way. Anyway. More explicitly, we can plot the reduction of superfluid density as a function of zinc concentration. So this graph shows the reduction of superfluid density with increasing zinc in the case of 2-1-4 series and 1-2-3 series, normalizing by pure value.
This is not optimal doping?
Hmm?
Optimal?
Yeah, this starts from underdoped 6.7 in the 1-2-3 case. In the 2-1-4 case, one of them is starting from optimal doped, one of them starts from a little bit overdoped. Okay. And
so you start from an eight?
Yeah.
If X equals an eight?
Yeah, the 1-8 story we will show you later, soon. Anyway, this behavior, we thought we could possibly explain very simply by just assuming that around each zinc creates an area of like pi coherence length squared region to be forcing it to be normal, just like vortex core forcing the region normal. And the remaining region we suppose to be superfluid. And then we can calculate the superfluid density just by knowing the number of zinc and the coherence length. So with these two informations completely independent from the experiment, we drew this line, what we call Swiss cheese model for this situation, the superfluid density variation.
Why isn't this a straight line?
Yeah. Hmm?
Where's the curvature from? In the Swiss cheese model, why is it not just a straight line?
It's not a straight line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting more concentrations, and these things starting to be overlapping, and so putting more zinc doesn't make sometimes effective reduction of area. It's just simple that calculation of area.
Well, like you really area.
Yeah, killing area stored. Anyway, so. Oh, this we used from sort of reasonable estimate of from HC2, which is about 10 or 20 angstrom. And anyway, this is not a fit. This is just an estimate. And somehow it agrees reasonably well with the experimental data. And furthermore, last year or 2 years ago, people in Berkeley, Simon Davis and his collaborators did STM experiment measurement for zinc doped 2212 and found a region, normal region shown here, to be something like the scale of 20 angstroms, which is very somehow well matching with our story.
Can I ask you on that? On the STM data, I think they're making a point, at least some of the people from this Berkeley group, that the recovery of the gap happens as you move to the nearest neighbor, you start seeing the gap peaks.
Yeah.
So intensity plotted there is intensity of this impurity state itself, but the gap peaks start seeing as you move away, say, 4 angstroms away from the neighbor.
Sasha, then he's not talking about the gap. He's talking about superfluid density.
Well, that's a question. I'm just... I'm trying to draw the attention to the fact that the gap peaks seen in STM do recover as you move to the nearest neighbor away from zinc site.
Yeah,
whereas your Swiss cheese model would seem to indicate that something is essentially zero within the radius psi around zinc.
This is, of course, approximation. The probably gap is anisotropy, like four-fold symmetry. And so, of course, this is just a miniature calculation. But I would like to say that qualitatively, somehow, situation seems to be consistent. Let's go to stripes. Okay. The first, actually, experiment we did on stripes is that volume 0.125 with zero TC. In zero field mu SR, we saw magnetic order. And this line shape is Bessel function, which is consistent with incommensurate field modulation. And so, and this is the case we expect for if 100% of the volume just shows that static magnetic order. The frequency goes to about 4 megahertz, which means that each couple has about approximately 0.35 or 0.4 Bohr magneton. So we can measure. Essentially, we can do the measurement, and I will show you that we can also measure the volume of ordered region and the strength of the copper moment in the ordered region. Then, recently, one of our colleagues made this European doped 214. European. We have to have europium because neodymium can, of course, do this, but neodymium is magnetic and it's not good for mu SR. It creates static field. And so europium is better. And for strontium concentration of 0.12, first of all, the 1/8 concentration, this europium makes, again, very nice Bessel function of for 100% volume being static frozen stripes. But if your whole concentration is 0.15, what we are seeing is, you see, that about half a volume shows this oscillation. Okay, the remaining half, this much, shows very just slow damping. And so this means that half a volume has static magnetic field of about the same, actually, magnitude as this one you can see from the frequency. So half a volume has static freezing, stripe freezing. The other half volume remains without static spin freezing. And this 0.15 whole concentration sample, fortunately, is also a superconductor. The TC of this sample is 30 Kelvin. So we can measure the superfluid density thanks to the remaining one half volume, which doesn't show magnetic order or as magnetic signal in our measurement. This is a result of the superfluid density increasing with decreasing temperature. The magnetic order occurs around here. So the first feature we are seeing is that somehow magnetic order, occurrence of magnetic order doesn't show too much effect to this variation of superfluid density.
Because it's spatially
occurring. This is as if saying that it's probably, even if it's occurring in a very close neighborhood, it's occurring in a different, possibly different region. The next thing we can do is by having zero temperature superfluid density, and again, see how this is correlated with TC. And that is shown here. So the point of this half strike frozen 214 system comes here. It seems again that TC is determined by the superfluid density. And so.
In fact, in pure 214, yeah. Pure 214 lies off your universal curve.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very important point that 214 doesn't behave as 123. And we do not understand the reason yet. It may be related to stripes, it may be related to...
So if you subtract off the stripe region, you will say it will go to that curve?
That's also, I don't know, just a minute. But just phenomenologically, this system, which has a half volume of frozen stripe, the superfluid density and TC is correlated in this way. And so actually, also, without stripes, this original material was here, 0.15 strontium was here, okay? Without europium, it's here. So just, it seems that half a volume was frozen magnetically, and also superfluid density was reduced by about a half. So it if you plot that, this is comparing to the area Swiss cheese of zinc, but you can plot the volume with static magnetism that we can measure by zero field mu SL here. So the half a volume, that particular sample is here. The one without europium has also, of course, no static freezing, and so you have here. And see how how the superfluid density is depleted with increasing volume of magnetic region. Unfortunately, we have only 2 points at this moment. We are trying to get more points.
Do you think they lie in straight lines?
this behavior somehow looks much like this. And you can speculate that the static frozen stripe region may be of the size of, I don't know, maybe coherence rank, so maybe a little bit larger, is not carrying superconductivity, but remaining region is carrying superfluid, and the superfluid density somehow determines TC. That way, we can more or less understand the result of this stripe system, and also with this zinc tube. Another stripe system we tried has a famous virginal crystal, so-called virginals, and other people at MIT found the overdoped 214 with overdoped atoms, overdoped oxygen, but without strontium. And this material has TC of 42 Kelvin, and magnetic order also occurs at 42 Kelvin. So it's robust static magnetic order and robust, very sharp superconductivity occurring at very high temperature. This is the stage 4 LSCO. And so we did, first of all, zero field mu SL to see the volume fraction of static frozen region, frozen stripe region. And this is the result. You know, this is approximately half or a little bit less. If you have 100%, you should have seen this kind of oscillation. Okay. So this system, it seems to me that magnetic volume is somehow less than half
Can you say it's within the layer, is half is alternating between layers?
No, we cannot say that, unfortunately. We can also extract the information of this frequency. Okay, so two information we can get from this frequency and the volume fraction that I will show you in the next graph. So the volume fraction is plotted here against temperature. This purple color is the crystal for which Tranquada measured the first important stripe work. And that has 100% volume. Okay, so this is the typical stripe system. And the frequency is about 3 megahertz or 4 megahertz. The Bergenau's stage 4 looks this. The volume fraction increases and saturates with about 40%. That frequency is about the same. Okay. Also, volume is gradually increasing. That's important. This is somehow suggesting that more and more sort of pinning or gradual decrease of fluctuation rate and getting static stripe freezing.
The frequency is
proportional to the static nearby Kappa moment. And also we have a famous Yamada crystal where Yamada reported that for 0.12 concentration the even lanthanum strontium as static stripes. And for that crystal, our estimate of the volume is only 20%.
Sometimes, does the volume, when you do transverse CO2 SR to measure the superconducting volume fraction?
Yeah, I will come to that later. Yeah, superfluid, I will show you later. So this is just the volume of magnetic, static magnetic. And again, so the frequency is the same. So this means that if it's really become static, the local spin structure seems to be not too much different. So it's hopefully real good stripe-like correlation. But the volume is very different. So we have to be careful when neutron scatterers report such and such system shows long-range order. It's possible that volume is substantially reduced from 100%. And of course, we did the measurement of superfluid density, and the result is shown here. We made some correction to compare single crystal with ceramics, and all other things are ceramics, and so that correction is made already. But this is a version of crystal. This is Yamada's crystal. And this is the 50%, you know, the European sample we already talked about. So, you know, I don't know, but it seems that somehow this is roughly consistent with the trend we earlier found for just whole doping situation. And so here, all these things have very vivid stripe freezing. But after all, in these systems, TC and superfluid density is correlating in a very similar, more probably predetermined way.
So superfluid density is different than that superconducting volume fraction.
If our speculation is correct, yes.
And the question I asked you before was, if you measure the superconducting volume fraction by measuring the amplitude of the precession of the transverse field, does that number add together with the number you get from the precession amplitude for the magnet to be 1?
Yeah, transverse field experiment shows loss of the signal from the magnetically static region.
I'm asking, do the numbers add up to 1? Is that loss?
Yeah.
So that's either superconducting or it's magnetic, add up to 1.
Well, but that's experimentally true, but we cannot experimentally determine if the superfluid is flowing in the magnetically ordered region or not.
No, but you could
ask
the amplitude of the circuit. You could ask, it could be that the magnetic, the the reason I'm asking is it could be that you get a number bigger than one, in which case you would know that some of the pieces that are magnetic are also superconducting.
Yeah, no, it's add up to one if you try.
Add up to one.
Yeah.
So he just measured the.
You measure the amplitude of the precession signal. He has two. That thing is a decay of the precession signal, and then.
But
that's
not
a good
measurement. He's measuring some
distribution.
No, but there's an amplitude for the decay as well.
Yeah,
we'll
discuss it later.
It adds up to
it. Okay. Let's go to overdoping. So overdoping again reduces TC. But, you know, this we have reported earlier in 1994, 93, maybe, that if just you overdope and if it becomes superfluid, we should have seen that TC goes down, but the carrier density should have gone up with overdoping. But the fact, the experimental result shows that superfluid density shrinks. And this is very anomalous, and it's the easiest way to interpret this is that out of all the 100% of carriers, only about, for example, in this case, this much becomes superfluid, and the remaining, by some reason, carriers remains as just a fermion or not participating in superfluid. Okay. So actually, for the case of overdoping, more and more you dope whole, but this is superfluid density. Superfluid density goes down. It should have gone up if it's just a simple BCS, like superconductor. This similar phenomena has been observed also by specific heat, Roram specific heat experiment. He found that overdoped thorium has two responses, this gapped response and ungapped response P. And if you just plot the volume ratio of gapped response, it goes very well with the superfluid density. And so this suggests again that the system has a gapped region and ungapped region. And so possible speculation is that by some reason you created this, just like the Swiss cheese like region, where it's ungapped, it's just fermions. And the other region somehow remains as a gapped superfluid. Okay. So I have been advocating, this is only a hypothesis, but in all these cases, various different ways of perturbation actually creates seemingly like a phase separation-like situation. It may not be real thermodynamic phase separation, but it's at least coexistence of two different regions, gapped and ungapped. And superfluid density is reduced, and probably because of that, TC is reduced. Okay, now, then we thought that how, let's compare this situation with helium film. So, of course, helium film, the study of superfluid density has been done many years by Cornell people, John Reppe, and the first in just pure Myra, so not much perturbed, pure film, the two-dimensional superfluid density and the superfluid transition temperature is linearly correlated. It's actually Coster-Sauer's transition. And so anyway, so TC, and this is TC, and superfluid density is roughly linearly correlated. And in the porous helium 4 in Bicol porous media, you do the same kind of measurement and you can find again that TC and superfluid density is within this system linearly correlated. And I would say that this porous media seems to me that is analogical to the zinc doped cuprates. If you dope zinc, probably the system has to have a healing layer, which is the Swiss cheese layer. And in this case, system makes healing layer around porous object, and still superfluid can flow thanks to the healing object. And superfluid transition temperature is determined by the superfluid density. The third case is even more interesting. We can...
Full four? Right, was that 2D or 3D?
This is 2D.
This is 2D. Case,
yeah, but no, this is reasonably porous. We have to go into the
limits. I don't know. How much more helium can you get in there to fill up all the pores? There's two experiments where you fill the bulk, all the empty space inside is filled with helium, or just the surface.
Oh, this is just the surface. Yeah. So this is the thin film. Okay, the third such surface thin film is. Third case is more interesting. This is helium-4, helium-3 mixture. And helium-4, helium-3, if in three dimension, makes a phase separation. It's quite well known. This is the phase diagram. So the more helium-3 you put in, the TC comes down. Again, almost determined by the amount of helium-4. The volume ratio of helium-4 determines. And this is bulk phase separation, but you can create thin film by putting it onto alumina powder. So Williams of UCLA made that experiment, and this is again this two-dimensional superfluid density of that helium and superfluid transition temperature, which is linearly correlated, and roughly speaking, it's Coster-Salas. Right. In my opinion, this situation may be comparable to overdoped, because this is, you are putting more and more fermions, forcing it in, and the system doesn't like it, and sort of separate into bosons and fermions. And it's boson part that actually determines superfluid transition temperature. So this is something I'm very glad to show you. This is the plot of TC versus two-dimensional superfluid density of those helium films. Again, so this is simple Myra case. This is Coster-Salas, right? This is the helium-4, helium-3 on alumina, which may be comparable to overdoped. And this is the porous media result. Now, so this is a helium-3, Uemura plot for helium thin films. And it's, I think, to me, amazingly similar to the case for cuprates. The approach here is a cuprate. And you see, this is overdoped. And
any connection
with
the slopes?
No, slopes I will come later. Slopes I will come later. Okay, so this is a pure Coster-Salas. This is not really pure Coster-Salas yet. So, but, but, you know. But at least, as phenomenology, I think in both cases there's a good chance that the superfluid density is really the determining factor for TC. Of course, you could expect some accidental correlation, but I think this is too good for being accidental. Okay. So, essentially, I would advocate a picture that, but zinc, or helium-3, or what overdoped fermions excluded from superfluid would be doing is just have some obstacle. And that reduces the superfluid density as total volume density. And then probably that is reducing TC. This kind of sort of hypothesis would lead us to propose a slightly new phase diagram for a cuprate. Previously, we have been saying more or less that Bose-Einstein to BCS crossover, but obviously the overdoped region is not behaving like BCS. In the BCS with retarded interaction, normal state carrier density should translate into superfluid density, but it's not happening. NS is different. Other than that, if you know, the overdoped region looks like helium-4, helium-3, and if also recently Caron and other people were advocating that T star may be sharply going down to here, so if T star represent pairing interaction, then your superconducting pairing interaction is rose very sharply here, but just like the helium-4, putting some helium-3, it's no longer really a boson. There's more helium-3 would just destroy that in a phase separation, because the system may be trying to still be staying superconducting with this optimal concentration, but under phase separation with fermion region and superconducting region. Okay, the second thing we might again learn possibly from this comparison with helium films is that obviously helium films, the bosons are formed way high temperature. And then what happens is that if you cool down to bulk lambda 2.2 Kelvin, they start qualified to be doing something super. But in some situation, if it's, you put in three dimension, it really becomes superfluid. But if the dimension is not three, but rather two or so, then it stays as fluctuating superfluidity until you really have satisfied real transition. And so there may be a good region that the system stays like this fluctuating superfluidity. So I wanted to say that there should be this way, there should be two distinct difference between, if this were a pair formation or boson formation, then there should be different line here, okay. Which is probably 150 Kelvin or so in energy scale for cuprates. And so, for example, the Joe Orenstein's experiment detecting this fluctuating super something goes to more or less like 100 Kelvin or 150 Kelvin. And so this is a good candidate for at least for a measurement to detect this line. It's not this line, I think. It's probably this line that...
Sorry, what's happening in this T lambda bulk? Physically, what are you ascribing that line? How should we be thinking about this dashed line, the T lambda bulk?
Yeah, but if you go above Kosterhout surface transition temperature, there's still vortex fluctuation remaining, right? And that vortex fluctuation would give you some signal, like actually this high frequency conductivity response. But that signal should, that signal should disappear at some temperature, and should never survive above the bulk lambda transition temperature. You cannot expect that kind of super anything for very, very high temperature. So this fluctuating superconductivity, superfluidity for helium, for example, you can never expect, I think, above 2.2 Kelvin. Maybe for some funny geometry, but 2.2 Kelvin is therefore a good measure for upper limit of fluctuating super phenomena, I think. And this, in my opinion, possibly is a way to measure that. And
shouldn't it basically be hugging the T3 line?
Yeah, yeah. This, well, how this is should be, or if it's really not like this and should come down, probably it might come down in many cases. Those are determined by more detailed dimensionality of actual situation. I think this is just conceptually saying that there should be this kind of energy scale.
Do you see that at the muon measurements themselves? Do you see any fluctuating?
Yeah, also, another candidate for this fluctuating super something is this Nernst thing. Again, it's going to something like 150 Kelvin, not to 500 Kelvin. And the third one is, I'm not sure if this is that or not, but this is Gabe's recent publication, which shows that even in the neutron intensity, there is, again, this possible indication of continuing time-dependent fluctuating super something up to about 150 Kelvin.
Can you see something in the viewer, sir?
No.
The high field or the transverse field?
No.
Because simply the time scale, the motional narrowing is
no.
Even when you reduce TC?
No, not up to now.
Even though it's at Forgan City.
Yeah. Anyway, so. So, you might have got impression that then story would be almost all just like Costeritosaurus up to now. I didn't say so, but you might have an impression that you know, everything looks like Herium and everything looks like Costeritosaurus. Oh, this is if you think that this gradually with zero this energy the pairs are formed. You know, of course it's unstable pair, but sort of charge correlations are made. You will start having effectively 2e like objects. These are e. Yes. Well, this is just to tell you that my speculation for this type is just a starting of pair formation.
Was that different from vortex fluctuations?
I think it's very different. The pair formation is a formation of bosons. So the pair formation, or boson formation for Helium's theorem, for example, occurs at extremely high temperature. But you have to cool down to something like 2.2 Kelvin to have expect anything related to vortex. Right? So this scale and this scale can be at least quite different.
What I understand from this in the orange surface plane, what I understand is that this is like what the material opposite is going to be. But the dashed line just follow
these. Oh yeah, this dashed line comes like that. Yeah. Yeah, this can come down. Please, this is conceptual drawing. It doesn't. I'm not claiming it. It is like this. It could come like this. Or so. Anyway, so far we have I think given you an impression that it's maybe just Costeritosaurus, but if I go back to some time scale, you know, originally we was trying to advocate that this so-called superfluid density correlation with TC and the pseudo gap may be interpreted as Bose-Einstein to Lissiez crossover. Right? And what I would like to stress is that if the energy scale of pair formation, or this the essential coupling energy scale, goes down rather slowly, maybe this is still, this is more like, theoretically, more natural thing to occur rather than phase separation. So whether or not phase separation would happen is how sharp this blue green line would decay here. Maybe, I don't know. That's one point. The another point is that so far we have, you might have an impression that it's very much like Costeritosaurus, but you can also get two-dimensional we can calculate the two-dimensional superfluid density from the measured three-dimensional superfluid density in various cubelets. This is a two-dimensional one, just you have to multiply the inter-layer distance to have two-dimensional density, and if you do so, no longer all different cubelets would align. And also, they are reasonably different from the Costeritosaurus line. If they were to really obey just the Costeritosaurus, it should have been following this line. But instead, it's not following that in absolute value, as well as it depends very much on interlayer distance. And this dependence on interlayer distance has been also found very early by the sandwich YBCO-PBCO multilayer film by Ersten Fischer group. And again, TC is roughly inversely proportional to the average distance of superconducting planes. So this means that three-dimensional coupling is important, is not negligible at all.
completely confused. So what is the difference between this measurement and your BOSR measurement? The superfluid density?
Oh, the superfluid density, I have been plotting three-dimensional superfluid density up to now. Okay, so all these area graphs or whatever, these graphs were three-dimensional superfluid density. Because the major, if you do measure the penetration depth, you will have major three. And 1, 2, 3, and so 1, 2, 3 and 2, 2, 2, 1 have different layer spacing. So you can convert these results to have two-dimensional superconducting carrier density. Yes, that's also, as you said, that's useful to see how it relates with Herrin result. And so if we do that, this is the case. And in some sense, this should have been compared with the Herrin graph.
Right.
And the Herrin graph, all the points were on here. Okay. But in the cuplets, it's not. In the cuplets, it depends, obviously depends on the inter-area spacing or inter-area coupling.
Are these all bilayer systems that you're comparing? How many, are these all bilayer systems you're comparing?
This is bilayer, this is single layer, this is also single layer. And actually for bilayers, there are choices between having these as one unit or
two. Well, there's factors of two there, that's why I'm...
In this case, we are counting the two adjacent layers as separate two layers. But of course that depends on choice, and that if we are to really be careful, we should do this experiment for various one-layer material.
And so none of those is a single-layer material.
This is two-layer. This is single-layer. This is single-layer.
Oh, there are two single-layer ones.
That's right. That's right. On the other hand, this case you put praseodymium layer, it's obviously sort of reducing in a systematic way the inter-layer coupling.
The implication of this insert is that putting praseodymium layer, you reduce the superfluid density in the plane?
No. Because most likely, my guess is that you would not reduce the superfluid density in one plane, but you would reduce the inter-plane coupling by putting more and more praseodymium layer in between. And that's probably why
TC would be determined by only two-dimensional density.
If TC were only determined by two-dimensional density, it should have been like this.
But your original plot was about only two-dimensional density there, right? You look at the different materials with different CX size, and all that matters was the purely two-dimensional NS2D, right?
Yeah.
Superfluid density per plane. So if I put, no matter how many praseodymium layers I put in, as long as I keep superfluid density in each plane the same, TC shouldn't change.
No. That's what we are trying to see by this experiment, if TC remains same or not. If it remains same, it's very much voting for Kostevitz-Salvis situation.
I thought your plot TC is proportional to rho S2D.
No. My plot shows TC is proportional to three-dimensional superfluid density.
So what this is saying is that actually, if you went to the three-dimensional case, but the three-dimensional case is more two-dimensional because that would be Joshua Salas. Is that what that's
Listen, my way of interpreting this is simple. If it's costed itself, there should be no dependence on inter-layer coupling. So even one day, one sheet of YBC or whatever should become superconductor with same TC. If it requires inter-layer coupling, sort of, I think we should go to slightly different way to the Bose-Einstein condensation in KSI-2D. These are not quite much different, but here this inter-layer coupling makes makes contribution to determine TC, and if you just assume that is given by simple distance dependence, we of course don't know if that is the case, then you will have TC being inversely proportional to the inter-layer distance, and that...
Where did the formula come from?
TC with the log?
This?
Yes, where did it come from?
Yeah, this is just like two-dimensional magnetic system. There's very little inter-layer coupling, and correlation length increases, and you know, then helped by inter-layer coupling, it gets three-dimensional.
You mean for ideal bosons, that no interaction, is that?
And this is actually many people. One of the first who used this for explanation of my prop is TDD, and his paper shows how you can get this. But just please think that this is something like a two-dimensional magnet, low-dimensional magnet. You need some three-dimensional coupling to have.
That's for O3 centipedes. It doesn't happen for an XY model.
But if you just have no interactions in the bosons, then it does, right? I mean, something happens.
Yeah.
You have the coupling of the
third. So experiment shows you have dependence on interlayer. Can I talk 5 more minutes? Okay. Now, so I have shown that, usually this is a high thesis phase diagram, so this should have been coming like this. And I was proposing it may be this. Now, there are two other superconductors that worth, again, analogy comparison. They are organic BEDT system that's two-dimensional, more or less analog to cuprets, and buckyballs. And I would like to show that we have found anomaly in this overdocked region. The same kind of anomaly exists here, organic BEDT, and possibly also here. You know, the organic system, we have to apply pressure to change TC. And unfortunately, MuSR cannot be done with a very large pressure cell. Organic crystals comes with very small amount. And so we cannot do penetration depths of by MuSR. We can do only in the ambient pressure case. That we did already, and the result is more like cuprets. But we recently did squid measurement under pressure to see how superfluid density behaves in this region. And in this, just measure the magnetization as a function of field, and perhaps many of you know that you can deduce the penetration depth from this slope. And in fact, the deduced penetration depth gives reasonably good agreement with MuSR-like estimation. It's about 5,000, 6,000 angstroms. And we can see the pressure dependence. And, okay. So, unfortunately, we could measure only down to 2 Kelvin. But, so this is zero pressure. If you reduce, if you apply more and more pressure and putting things close to just Fermi Rigid, the TC is reduced, but superfluid density is reduced as well. And this is a plot of TC versus superfluid density at, unfortunately, this is only at 0.35 TC. But most likely this would represent the tendency of ground state superfluid density. And what you find is, again, TC and the superfluid density is linearly, roughly linearly related. And furthermore, you could also make another plot. This is superfluid density, again, one of lambda squared 0.35 TC, plotted just as a function of pressure. And this is just showing that your superfluid density decreases with increasing pressure. However, if you just naively, if you pressurize a metal, you would create, you would get a smaller effective mass by more pressurizing. And In fact, effective mass has been measured by Duhas van Alphen effect under as a function of pressure in this system. So, and also the carrier density has been measured by Hall effect, and they confirmed that there is no much difference in pressure. So carrier density stays constant. Effective mass of normal state carrier would decrease with increasing pressure, just like usual picture for any metal. And so this normal state property, n over m star, goes up like this. This is what the Duhas van Alphen would say, has said already. And this is what superfluid density behaves. So again, they are behaving oppositely, just like in the case of overdoped cuplet. And so, you know, this is another possible case for anomalous phase separation or whatever reason, that normal state transport property doesn't reflect into superfluid. And the similar story exists for buckyballs. This is just experimental result of TC versus, again, superfluid density. This is for overdoped to thallium, and the buckyball is this. Buckyball is this. And again, the buckyball, essentially you can change system, the composition but or the atoms, but it's essentially changing the pressure. And this is a way that you pressurize. The more and more you pressurize, TC goes down, but superfluid density goes down. The simple band calculation would predict that the this inverse density of state behaves like this, which is just the same that as for normal matter, you more and more pressurize, you know, you get less and less density of state, so inverse density of state would go up. And this is, in some sense, this is the only available measure for n over m star in the case of buckyballs. And this is at this observed superfluid density behavior. In the case of buckyballs, you know, there may be severe effect of scattering because mean free path may be not that long. So buckyball may be subject to dirty limit correction. And in that case, we have to be careful about even wording of superfluid density, if it should mean 1 over lambda square like real superfluid, or if it should mean something before or after this correction was made. So for buckyball, story is not clear. But at least phenomenological tendency is the same. You apply pressure in both systems, and system somehow seems to undergo phase separation like thing. Whatever, some anomalous thing. Okay, so this is the end of my talk. Somehow, so if you believe all this, TC is determined by a volume average of superfluid density, but averaged in rather not really small length scale, but sort of medium kind of length scale. If you average things by coherence ranks, you will get some region which has very high TC and some region which has very no TC. So coherence ranks is shortest in averaging. You would need probably something like 10 times coherence ranks to describe the situation. But and when I talked about this to Paul Chaykin, he said, so that's wrong. It shouldn't be like that. But so he didn't believe my story yet. But you know, one possible length scale which appears in some kind of such argument is probably this. You know, if you put Karen films, and if you increase the thickness, After some thickness, it behaves just like three-dimensional Herrim, so you no longer effectively increase the amount of superfluid. So this length scale, maybe Steve knows better than me, but is something like, I don't know, 10 times coherence length or whatever. Yeah. So some such length scale. And so this means at least for this Herrim film, you need to average the count the carriers with that medium length scale. And if that length scale exists, then that volume averaged superfluid density in high TC seems to be determining TC. Thank you.
Fair to say that in some way your phase separation occurring over on the overdoped side
Yes.
seems different to us than some of the things we think about the cuprates, where somehow the underdark side is occurring. But is it because you picture that when you talk about phase separation, I need to have somehow striped or already structured regions separated yet from others? It somehow seems different to me than the picture of the T versus doping that various people have talked about, where the sort of phase separation is occurring more easily in the underdark region somehow than.
Yeah, there may be phase separation happening also in underdark region.
But
we assure is, if you don't know about phase separation, you, especially any superconductor, if you measure superfluid density, it's almost linear in TC. So, right? So that means underdark region may also have phase separation, but. At least there is no indication for usual underdark region that magnetic freezing occurs. So that's different from stripe, typical stripe case. Still, there is some data which might suggest that system is not homogeneous.
I guess there was, Chris Hamill had data and Slicker had data that was indicating, I kept it in the somewhat underdark region. Hamill basically talking about some type of spin freezing of some type.
So that also apparently coexisting with superconductivity, and so probably it's again sharing the volume, maybe. If there's a way to determine the magnetic region, we could probably do the same thing.
So about a higher temperature, I mean, can you look at the two regions? Presumably have different night shifts. And so can you see you have phase separation, then there are two different night shifts.
The
question is, have you picked that up? And you see, does the phase separation occur only below TC or at TC? Or already in the
here?
Magnetic
region. There's not direct evidence yet to really show spatial phase separation. It's so therefore only my speculation at this moment. But
there's only one night shift.
But you know, first of all, this spontaneous region of ungapped fermions may be fluctuating. If it's pinned, probably scanning tunneling microscope can probe it. So we are, of course, advocating Davis to do this. And actually, they may be trying that. Right? If it's dynamic, then the time scale determines which probe can determine, which probe can find out the separation.
But you didn't answer the question, did you do night shift measurements to see different distribution of night shifts?
No.
You have not yet done that?
No.
Because in the NMR, NMR measurements have been done, which indicate that the phase separation occurs rather close to TC for certain samples. There's only one environment above them.
Yeah. Also, I'm sorry, this is probably not related to your question, but I forgot to stress one thing. This line has been advocated by Taron and Roram very much. And their experimental work is, I think, very useful. But when interpreting that, they are arguing that essentially T star is not necessary for overdoped superconductor. So therefore, because T star is, if T star is stopping here, therefore, their argument goes that T star is unrelated to superconductivity. So I'm providing another way to view the same phenomena, but still saying that T star is really essential for superconductivity, but it is phase separation which gives you overdoping. So this is a message to Roland and Talon.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.